Okay, good evening. This is Wednesday night. It's Chapter 5 of Life in the Labyrinth. We've been working our way through some of the books of E.J. Gold, and now we're on Life in the Labyrinth. And this is one that was published in 1986, and that whole period of time, a great deal was published, Ivan. Mm-hmm. And we were doing what I call the slow reading process. We're taking the time to penetrate the material rather than to just get through it. And the purpose of that is that we're not interested in the accumulation of the linear data more than to just say ease into what the true meaning and understanding behind that, what EJ is talking about here in this material. And we can see from the earlier chapters, the first four chapters, we are able to do that. It's taken us a while to get to chapter five. A few of these chapters really have taken us a couple of weeks to get to. That's okay. We're not in a hurry. What we are interested in is participation. And the members of the groups that are online on Gorbag TV or that are posting on wingsofchaos.com, where we have the website, have a lot of accumulated time working on themselves. So we're hoping to this simply to be a focus for that to come out in a particular manner. So let's turn our attention to the chapter then. And the book I'm working from is the this newer edition, and Ivan, you have the older edition there. And I don't know if the pagination is very different. Mine starts on page 35.
Well, I'm on 32, but you know what? I've been going backwards. This is actually the dog-eared first edition. It doesn't even have the illustrations in it.
Oh, well.
So maybe back a couple of pages.
Yeah. Okay, so... Ivan, why don't you get us started by go ahead and read the header there.
Summary, huh?
Yeah.
Neural network projections. Our knowledge of the environmental world is entirely dependent upon synaptic processing of organic perceptions which come to us at the speed of light. Still, this is not fast enough to be in the present. Bypassing those organically bound perceptions can provide us with the possibility of direct, unfiltered views of the real world, unencumbered by the brain and its significances.
As you go through this, look, there are tons of sites out there where there's vigorous intellectual debate on a lot of this fourth way material, the Sufi material, that you can participate in. We're not that. We're not attempting to analyze the provenance of a lot of the writings that were out there. What we're doing is taking this material as a guide to penetrate for information that we have. And I'm saying that because if you read just this first header here, it's powerfully loaded. And as Harry noted in one of his postings, just that very middle phrase there, the processing of organic perceptions, upon synaptic processing of organic perceptions, which come to us at a speed of light, still, that is not fast enough to be in the present. How could that be?
Yeah, I was wondering about that. I think that always... A lot of things in this chapter stumped me the first time I read it.
So that phrase alone, this is a riddle. This is a riddle that is solved by the experience that is pointed to in that riddle.
Okay.
I'll go ahead and expand, okay? I'm going to go ahead and expand on my comment there. The neural processing, and as soon as we get into the neuroscience area, I'm out of my league. I read it only as an amateur, not deeply as some people do, but as a dilettante. But, so if the processing is happening at the speed of light, which is, there's nothing faster than that, how could it be that it's not fast enough to be in the present? Because in by virtually by definition, that is linear. It is deductive and linear by its nature. I get there at the speed of light.
Mm-hmm.
Versus in presence, there is no speed of light. There isn't the back and forth of step one, two, three, and four.
Mm-hmm.
Once in the presence, there is no sense of time. Time is not part of that. We should be getting beginning to get a sense of that by standing in our presence and practicing that. And when we start to see that, we start to see how that could even make sense. So a lot of the literature that comes out of these teachers are on their face, they're riddles, and they're riddles that are solvable by us. And we have the tools right now to begin to solve them. So we'll move off of that for the moment.
Okay.
But before the end of the class, I'd like Harry to either recall something or I will read something that his group came up with that's very useful. And then at the first few paragraphs, what EJ is doing is describing the mechanisms of the brain and the fact that various nervous systems, which are properly part of the lower organic mental apparatus, the brain can be likened to a small complex labyrinth resembling a three-dimensional matrix composed, among other things, of neural pathways. We understand this. Now, 25 years since this was written, Ivan, there's been an enormous amount of research
mm-hmm.
on the brain. And the highest level of these researchers still have the question, what is consciousness? They're still attempting to find it. Now they're starting to define it by saying what it's not. So no one can quite put their hand on this. But we understand that there are literally physical synaptic pathways that thought, in a sense, goes through. There's firing. And that happens in a matrix of neural patterns that are there.
Yeah, well, I've noticed that, you know, maybe it's just from some research that I've come across that students of mine have grabbed onto, you know, and put into a few academic papers. But I get the impression that there's now research. There's the belief is stronger, I think, than it used to be, that artificial intelligence can be, you know, that consciousness will eventually come about for artificial intelligence. You know, that just the adequate complexity of these computer chips, you know, and creating, in other words, creating the reflection of the neural networks to the brain is going to produce not just a simulation of human thought, but that awareness of self-consciousness is going to arise from that. It seems like a somewhat peculiar belief, let's say, from our point of view. I mean, you know.
But even there, what's happening is they're saying it's going to reach some level of complexity so far beyond our current knowledge, we're going to call that consciousness. And that's,
maybe.
I mean, but this is what, this is what science fiction writers have been talking about for
decades.
Well,
what I'm thinking of, you know, and maybe Harry would have a comment on this, you know, when EJ proposes the exercise to place your attention on the source of the tension, that, you know, my question is an artificial intelligence going to be able to do that exercise?
It depends whether you've programmed it to do that.
All right, we'll go there.
And then he says that the brain can be viewed as a veritable ocean of probabilities, and that really the neural pathways are can be viewed in a certain way as a probability of how they will pass forth. But in a certain way, at that point, we're talking, I think, about the tabula rasa, the blank slate, is the probability. Electrical energy passes through the brain in a series of decreasing options, each neural grouping acting as a branch of an inverted tree. And energy in the form of electricity and heat enters in at the trunk, descending into the larger upper branches, eventually forced by decreased options into one or another of the medium branches, and then smaller and smaller branches, so on, till it finally comes to rest because it has run out of choice points. This is the same as if entropy. Mm-hmm. Which kind of makes sense, right? Within the brain, we find we have the equipment and the stomach to look for it, certain positive electrical potentials, openings which, like chemical valences, favor the passage of negative electrical energy, and correspondingly, each grouping of negative electrical energy has waveform, electrical morphological topology, and because it has form, tends to favor one pathway or another. What we're being set up for here is we're beginning to look at the mechanics that the brain, these neural pathways, in a sense, are programmed. They're programmed to proceed in a certain manner. Mm-hmm. That's the point here. And Harry, is that what you found in your group when you were starting to study this?
Yes, but that the whole notion of internal representational space where the brain creates the analog construct, a map of the external world, whatever that is. And that's basically what we're dealing with, and it's the only thing that we can respond to.
Right.
Yeah, and that goes back to the point of not being in the present. In other words, whatever it is that we call, our perceived reality is something that comes from a process in the brain.
That's right. Now,
yes, it's a sensory process, so it's a machine function. So by definition, consciousness is not, it's not in the same domain.
Correct.
Yeah.
Well put.
I think that's what he gets at in this chapter. But this whole opening seems to me to be he seems to be talking about the physical apparatus, you know, it's like the physics not consciousness, the physics of thinking. You know, what it means to have the mechanics of thinking. Yeah, to have phenomena going on in the brain.
And, you know, like at UCLA and some of the other big campuses, they're literally mapping the brain.
Oh, yeah.
And they're mapping where things occur. And these are huge projects.
David, they're also discovering that there are a lot of functions that are not site-specific that have... You lose a sense, for example, and that portion of the brain that normally does it is no longer used. That real estate, that neural real estate, will be co-opted by another function, so the brain is very plastic.
So something drives it in that manner, and
right.
You'll see this like in the work of Antonio Damasio. He wrote a particular book where he's starting to study the brain and the emotions, like you're talking about, Harry, and when he's talking about people who have brain injury, where they simply have unusual characteristics where they just don't feel an emotion in a particular manner because that part of the brain is gone.
Mm-hmm.
But
right.
The function, their ability to function, continues. And we're all aware of the fact that we actually don't see the objects in front of us. What we get is we get electrical impulses hitting our eyes, and then that impulse is interpreted, and we call it a picture. we call it a camera. We call it a share. So if you can start to get the sense of that, you can start, it starts to be slightly upsetting in its own way, because we're not seeing that. We're actually not perceiving that directly.
Right. You mean what we, these images that we have in our minds and so on are constructed.
They're necessarily constructed.
By the neural network.
If I hold this thing up here,
mm-hmm.
and you look at it, your eye doesn't have the capacity to discern that this is a book.
Right. So it's,
it gets processed in the brain,
right.
and a conclusion gets reached.
If you call it a book, it's a projection of the meaning you have assigned to it.
There right. you go. That's well put. It's a projection of the meaning that we have assigned to it.
Right. Sure.
So we don't want to accept these things. We don't want to accept that part of it. But it's like EJ is going one step deeper here and saying to us, he's pushing our consciousness to look at this, to really, really look at this. Jumping ahead just a little bit, each twisting and turning in this three-dimensional branching system represents a corresponding twisting and turning in the giant labyrinth called creation. And in this sense, the brain is a unique type of mirror. Reasonably complex analog simulation system. Reality, as we ordinarily perceive it, is determined by only that part of the neural networking which happens to be momentarily active because we are in a particular portion of the neural network. We project its significance upon the environment. That's the point. Okay? The neural network provides us with whatever significance we happen to devise for ourselves to explain that external reality. And then he takes it to the next level. In addition to that, we have specific ways of organizing our perceptions according to what is commonly called a headset. Headset will influence who we seem to be ourselves, our self-view, which in turn must, as a matter of course, profoundly affect our sense of where we are, what we choose to perceive, what we choose to perceive. That's really important. How we understand our actions and our impressions and of the meaning of what we're doing. A headset comes prepackaged with a self-contained set of associations. And that's what we're being told to look at here. The linear brain, the human biological machine as it is, it's following a neural pathway. And the neural pathway, it's a headset. In this sense, as we voyage through the labyrinth, it is not so much that we experience dimensional transition, it is more accurate to say we actually remain in the same location in view of the fact that dimensions are all contained in the same space. We briefly talked about that last chapter. And that we experience a change in headset.
David, may I offer something about headset?
Please, yes.
I think a good example of it is the old saying that when a pickpocket meets a saint, he sees only his pockets. That's a headset. Somebody else may see a saint. Other people may see a person that's just standing on the corner, and many others will just completely not recognize them at all.
And I think another version of that is that when Socrates or Diogenes...
We don't see the world as it is. We see it as we are.
Yeah, when Socrates goes out in the streets, he meets everybody as a philosopher. Everyone's a philosopher.
To Socrates, right. He has that ability. And And I think that the headset is what we carry around. The point of that is that that's generally how we perceive the world. And that headset is pretty much pre-programmed. It comes from just how we were raised. How we were raised, you were raised in a different way than I was, Ivan.
Mm-hmm.
You see things that I don't see. I see things that you don't see. And that's based on our headset. So the invitation here, of course, is can we think about stepping out of that headset?
Right.
The amount of perception we are able to perceive and process, modified by the increase or reduction of brain-created occlusions, so I'm not sure I get that phrase, determined by our momentary state, which in turn is determined by a variety of modifiers, the cataloging and conscious control of which have eluded philosophers, etc. Well, we don't know, and it's still, the neurologists yet still do not know where it comes from or what its source is. And then he goes on, in the real world, we are always in the same chamber. So now, he's referring to the world of the essential self and the world of direct perception, which then viewed through varying subjective perceptual filtrations gives us the impression that we voyage unaccountably from one dimensional level to another, alternately seeming to experience expanded and contracted space modified by variable time frames. This is heady stuff, I know, and it's not very different flavor than the last chapter. But what we're trying to be pointed out to us, it's trying to be shown to us that there's a physical correspondence to the mechanicality of the machine. Okay? There's a physical correspondence to it. And it's possible to do something about that. But it in itself is fixed in its own manner. That's the headset.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
We
are in a machine.
In a biological machine.
We're in a biological machine. Molly, is there anything that we need to read? Okay.
Contributions online.
Mm-hmm. So there's an internal
transformation.
Well, I have to repeat it. So
start over again.
There's an internal transformation and distillation in the brain
of the signals from the world.
This is Mark Roche speaking. And so then on top of that, we add our own imaginary,
and ultimately arbitrary
and truly arbitrary
meaning.
Thus the phrase,
all phenomena is illusion.
Well put, Mark.
Okay, there's a formulation. Mark has a formulation of what, John Lilly's famous statement about, the limits of, the limits of reality. The limits of our reality have to do with the belief system that we're living inside.
And Mark, and this is a reason why we don't like to go some of us don't like to go out and meet other people because that headset.
Because even that is a threat to our reality.
Because that's a threat to our reality. Because we encounter those that have a different set of imaginary projections upon which they construct their world. And those conflicts, we don't want that. That's one aspect of it. But it's only by going out and interacting that you have the opportunity to begin to free yourself from your own headset. Because we're not concerned about other people's headsets here.
Okay.
That's their headset. I mean, we're concerned about the headset that we carry around.
Okay.
When we change headset, an experience which, to the attentive voyager, immediately translates into a change of dimension. It is more than just our perspective which changes. The alteration of our point of view is so profound, so radical, that it goes far beyond a newfound ability to think in new categories. A change in headset is practically equivalent to a brain transplant, or it is, in fact, a brain bypass. So what's going
profound?
Yeah. So if you can allow a headset modification to occur, you can stand in a different place. You are literally able to stand on new territory, on new ground. And as we said before, and upon this is, loose your shoes, for this is holy ground. And that's true. At that point, you begin to stand in presence.
David, do you think that being an actor or practicing acting would help someone change headset more easily?
I thought about that. I've been thinking about that because sometimes I'll watch a movie or something and I'll watch the actor, knowing that it's a human being in front of a camera, and knowing that they are putting themselves in a position to where they have to change emotions. My conclusion is that the answer is probably yes. It probably, I mean, it depends on the actor.
Yeah, could I have a comment on that, Harry, which is, I did some theater when I was in high school and early in college, and I would say that that didn't work that way for me. And the reason is that I wasn't really cut out to be an actor. In other words, I wasn't throwing myself into it to the extent that, like a method actor, where I was able to become that character. It seems to me that if you take the approach to acting that you're going to invoke this other character on yourself, you know, you're going to become like what's her name. Meryl Streep studies.
That's exactly who I was thinking of.
Meryl Streep studies, the woman who was the British Prime Minister?
Margaret Thatcher.
Thatcher, yeah. And I heard this wonderful interview with Streep, and she said, and they asked her, like, well, how did you, you know, you don't, and she admitted that she never liked Margaret Thatcher, never cared for her, didn't like her politics and so on. She said, well, how did you do such a wonderful Margaret Thatcher? And she said, well, I started with the accent, you know, I got a coach and we did all this training, and when I got her accent down, then it was came, you know, after the manner of speech came the gestures and the postures, and then came the manner of thinking, and then the manner of feeling, and you know, she basically worked herself into Thatcher, into Thatcher's character. And I'm just saying that that's, you know, I memorized parts and performed as an actor going anywhere near that.
You performed as Ivan Lurie.
Simulating somebody.
King Lear.
Well, no. I don't
or whoever you were simulating.
That would have been the same.
Whereas, so in that method, exactly what Ivan was just telling us, I think Meryl Streep had to overcome her headset. In her case, she didn't even care for the person.
Yeah, but she literally needed to leave behind her entire attitude and impressions, let's say, of Margaret Thatcher.
Yeah.
And she came to impersonate her instead.
And so you had to go, okay, how does she speak? How does she move her hands?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, well, I move my hands in a very particular way. But Margaret Thatcher moves her hands in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
What if I were to begin adopting that? That by itself puts you in a position where you have to overcome certain of the neural programming that we're talking about in this chapter thus far.
David, from an NLP perspective, doing that precise thing is called matching and mirroring practice in NLP, and it's pretty essential for getting rapport with people, particularly if you don't really like them.
Matching and mirroring, it's called?
Yeah.
Matching and mirroring, and also backtracking, repeating what they say in the same way in which they say it.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So that's a way of developing empathy, is that the idea?
Right. Most NLP trainings will start with a week or two of doing just that.
It's getting in, and you get into, I've not done NLP, but I tend to do what you just said naturally, Terry.
Yeah, that's why the NLP people use it, because they pirated it from people like you who use it. I mean, it's a natural process.
It is a natural process, and it's basically, and there's some, it's interesting because there's some people I can't go near because of that.
Because you can't simulate them?
I'm afraid to.
Oh, you're afraid to.
And,
yeah.
I met some, let's just call some people who, they were very rough trade, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, really tough. And I could sense where they were at, and I didn't want to be around them.
Go there.
Because in order to be with them, I would kind of have to go there. And I rejected that. Very good.
So you had no desire to establish rapport.
Yeah, right.
Well, yeah, that's correct. None whatsoever in that case.
You probably wanted to establish escape.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's best to leave Dodge.
Yeah,
right. I left Dodge in that particular
discretion
case.
Is the better part of valor is another thing.
So So where we are, it says a change in headset is practically equivalent to a brain transplant. And that's really what these great actors and actresses do, like Sean Penn. I mean, this guy's played every role you can think of. You know, I mean, from a, I don't know what you call it, but where he, in I Am Sam.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
He was mentally,
yeah.
It was like a...
Yeah.
A person with 70 IQ. He knocked it out of the ballpark. And he had to study. He went to live with those people for a while. And mannerisms is a lot of it. Accepting the mannerisms of the other. Thank you, Harry. Very good. So, now we continue. Changing headset is a basic prerequisite, a beginning exercise which prepares us for serious voyaging in the labyrinth, leading us eventually to discard all acquired primate nice, what is that?
Nine tendencies,
tendencies, and so on.
11 tendencies.
So, primate tendencies. And so, one thing that can happen that's interesting is that when you are in a voyaging space, you can begin to see your tendencies, what you shy away from, and you can guide yourself into those areas. That has the effect of freeing you up from that headset when you come out of that labyrinthine space. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Curious. So I'm going to be posing a question. I don't know if we're going to make it through this chapter but...
Probably need another week for this chapter.
Okay, and then I'm on 38 now in the new edition. The imposition of primate imperatives upon perception and reaction can only serve to impinge upon higher experiences and distort them. We'll learn to use various means to ensure that in the macro dimensions, the primate is well anesthetized. So we'll learn to use various means. And I pose the question, do we learn that as we go through the book? So keep that in mind. So one of the things that has to occur is that as we get into these dimensions, the primate machinations have to be quieted. How do we do that?
Comments? Online comments?
The mirror neurons, I know, but I'm looking at the tape here too. They're trying to get some of the data on there for the people listening. So there's a conversation online that's discussing the mirror neurons, and is it Ramachandran, the great Indian neurologist, who talks about mirror neurons. And the concept in the mirror neuron is that if you see somebody else, let's say, scratch like this, you have a bit of a sympathy with that movement. You're not even doing it. But you have the same, there's a sympathy of response there.
If you put a PET scan on a person like that, David, they will actually show the same neural signature as the person doing the scratching.
Okay, so that's fascinating. That's a fascinating thing, particularly when we're talking about the idea that we are electrical bodies. We're electrical bodies, and right now we can simply say things like, I scratch, I can map the fact that you have the same response, but we haven't yet, I don't think that anybody is mapping what I call the electrical influence of one upon another. Nevertheless, it seems tangibly clear that that's occurring. Do you agree that that's the case, Harry?
I'm sorry, David. I was multitasking here. Could you ask me that again? Set that up again.
We're talking about these mirror neurons,
right,
and the fact that the mirror neurons respond to perceived tasking, like somebody bites into an apple, and you probably salivate slightly when you see that, possibly even as you consider it right now as I'm saying it.
Right.
Okay, so you can map that, but we haven't got to a point where we can map the effect of one electrical body on another. And my question to you, Harry, is it evident to you that that is the case, that we have an electrical effect one upon another?
As to whether or not there's research on that, David, I don't know. I don't think so.
I do not believe
the electrical effect we are aware of.
Correct. So, if we're aware of the electrical effect that we have on each other, something like the mirror neuron principle is occurring there.
Yes,
but it's
not necessarily occurring
in the brain. It's occurring in the electrical body.
David Hawkins calls this the etheric brain.
Etheric brain?
The etheric brain. He's a guy that has a different approach to this.
Okay. I'm very interested in that because I am, about 3 or 4 years ago, I'm just so much so convinced of the idea that we operate through a sixth sense that I call this electrical body. I see more with that, I think. It's not that I see more. I'm more confident in my perception of that than I am of my physical perception.
David, Sharon Begley talks about this very thing in her book where they did a lot of studies with Dalai Lama's monks in 2004 and found that it was the right ventrolateral prefrontal cortex that lights up like a tree. It's on the right side of the brain, which happens to be the same area that lights up when people name emotions that they're feeling.
Uh-huh.
So perhaps there is some connection there.
Interesting.
I have seen PET scans of monks doing it, and it's a very large area for them, just like for fiddle players like Ivan. See, that portion of the brain that deals with manual dexterity is more lit up, has more metabolic activity because he plays the violin.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I hope so.
Well, and also, all of the philosophers talk about that to do many different things, many different tasks, is a way of beginning to break apart the headset that we carry around with us. Do something
right.
Different. And when you do something different with the qualities that we currently have, we do break into new areas.
I would like to see some research on the electrical body effect. I think that's would be fascinating.
Well, I'll look up her work, Sharon Begley.
Yeah, you know, actually, this might interest you, Harry. I don't know if I ever told you this story, but I've had a few very vivid experiences of, you know, electrical fields. I mean, between people, and I was once in the post office in Nevada City, and somebody a little behind me or ahead of me, I forget, was in the lobby of the post office, somebody had a grand mal seizure. You know, this person was fell down on the ground and having a seizure, and somebody had the presence of mind to get a pen or something like that, to wrap up a pen and a handkerchief and put it in that person's mouth. And, you know, I was just going to the P.O. box to pick up mail, you know. But I got near that person, I felt waves of, I got a convulsive feeling directly from that person's seizure. And that was so vivid that I never forgot that. I mean, and what that reminded me of was other milder forms of that experience where I feel that where states that people are in, emotional states,
right,
physical postures and things, have directly somehow communicated to me. Yeah. But that one was really memorable, you know. It was like I got a bodily feeling that was not my own. It was completely foreign
right.
to myself. Yeah.
We've all felt what angry people feel like.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there's a contagion. Yeah. It seems like you could figure other routes to explain, you know, a contagion of emotions, or you know, like the when a ripple of something passes through a whole crowd of people or something. You know, it may or may not be electrical. But, you know, this idea, I mean,
it is electrical.
Yeah.
It is electrical.
Yeah.
And but this is why in some of the practices, for instance, Sat Nam, is just literally sitting with the teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually experienced this up in Seattle not that long ago, where there was a teacher from, you know, basically the Hindu tradition, but that's exactly what they did. You just sat with them, and there was no question that they had the ability to transmit.
Mm-hmm.
And so we look at these, that's part of the role that the teacher provides. I maintain that is opening the door for us to learn what to do with that.
Right. or how to voluntarize it also. Yeah.
If we're able to voluntarize, but we have to do something with it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, very good. If, on the other hand, we are relatively free from the human headset, we are able to position ourselves anywhere in our internal neural network and project a position upon our present perceptual surroundings. So basically, if there's some resilience in our headset, if we have some mobility, we can move back and forth of where we need to be internally, in a sense. I experience this all the time, where I'm on the phone 1 minute with a client, I'll hang up, 10 minutes later the group calls. It's a radically different headset.
Right.
What an opportunity. What an opportunity that is for me. And I'm very thankful for that. So, and then he goes on to talk about jaunting. And as Alfred Bester,
right,
he's talking about there. And that's a form of teleportation, but we're talking about inner teleportation. Now, I want to emphasize that. It's like, can you go to that space, is what I want to say. Can you go to that space where you were in that particular place? Can you get there internally? Now, sometimes we can match that space and we can show someone that space and help them get to there. But can you get to a particular space internally when asked to do so? If you can, then you've moved beyond the headset controlling you and you're at the beginnings of being a labyrinthine voyager. Make sense?
Sure. Yeah. And I would think again there would be various techniques for doing that, you know, which might involve the visualizations, signs and symbols.
Some of it is going to be paying attention.
Yeah.
Just get into your attention body and invoke your presence.
Yeah.
And when you invoke your presence, then you have a rudder, the beginnings of a rudder, to do something, okay? Neural network projection is a way of saying that we exist only in the world that we perceive. How many of us have had the situation where you walk into a room or someone's talking and then somebody points something out and you say, I never knew that was there. I didn't see that before. Have you had that experience?
Yeah, definitely.
How could it be? Your eyes were still working. It wasn't occluded. But suddenly somebody points to it and you go, oh, I didn't see that before. With great surprise. Imagine the world as an ocean at the edge of which the human biological machine stands like a lonely lighthouse in a rocky cove, its eyes acting as reverse beacons who live in the darkness of the brain, and they can never see the ocean. But through the eyes of the lighthouse, we are able to know something of the outer world.
David, isn't he just saying that it would be advisable to the extent that we can to remove those occlusions so that we can more directly perceived and not have so much going on in terms of projection on the environment so that we can see more of what's actually there?
Absolutely. And the hard part of that, of course, is beginning to see what are our occlusions. What are we occluded to? What occludes us from moving into these other spaces. We have accidental perceptions of these other spaces, and we love it. We love to be there.
But aren't those attractions and repulsions?
Well, the attractions and repulsions are fundamentally everything flows through desire. And when we can drop the desire, and in those spaces, the desire
right.
is less evident. Because, like the ego, it's almost infinite. Of course, you know, the Buddha says that the desire is the hatching of all confusion. And Spinoza, at the beginning of Book 3 on human emotions, says all emotions flow begin desire. This is a 16th, 17th century philosopher. Said exactly the same thing. I'll read it to you one of these days. So yeah, attractions and repulsions. The eyes see the real world in the raw. And this is when we're in that space, we do see the real world directly. The perception is not through the senses, it's through a different mechanism. And I'm not sure how that works, Harry, and how that's going to play out in the whole concept of in neuroscience. But there does seem to be a way of perceiving directly.
Yes, I don't know if the neuroscientists have pegged that at all yet. I'm not a reductionist, so most of them are.
Yeah, correct. Well, also, Harry, I think you touched on an issue here, which is regarding the occlusion. I mean, it may be that you could analyze or find occlusions to the brain's clearer perception or simulation of this outside world, but it seems to me that in this chapter, EJ is talking about a form of direct perception which is bypassing the brain. He actually used that
yeah.
phrase, I think, some paragraphs earlier. So
yeah.
we're not talking about removing occlusions so that the brain can experience the world directly. It's like saying, again, I think it goes back to that exercise of to put your attention on the source of attention. Because I think that what EJ is teaching is that the attention and presence, in regard to the essential self, attention and presence are not coming from the brain. They're not coming from this neural network.
I agree. That's my understanding.
They're not coming from the physical pathways, from the complexity of the physical pathways, which is why I personally am skeptical that any development in AI produced presence.
But Ivan, would it not be also the case that likes and dislikes have to be regarded as a bodily function? That's a machine function, both of those. So if you can eliminate those and reduce them, you're left with this nonlinear awareness.
That's right.
Sure.
Well put.
Well,
you don't create the nonlinear awareness. All you do is drop the obstacles. Isn't that what we're doing here, all of the efforts that we make?
Yes. Well, you know, going back to the previous book, there's the waking state of the machine. So as I recall, the absence of negative emotions, right, is one of the signs or the necessities for that waking state.
Yeah, that's a technique.
Yeah.
We're not going to make it through the rest of the chapter, as I can see. I just wanted to ask Molly if there's more that we need to get off the log and stay into the recording, or are we okay at the moment?
Well, we could, yeah, you know, we could just call for comments at this point, you know, like comments that Harry or anybody else might have on this, what we've read so far. Right. Yeah, David talked about that.
Yeah, so what person was saying that as they hike and they suddenly see or is pointed out a plant or fungus on the side, then they see it all the time. He was invisible up to that moment, and then they can see. And now I can see. Go ahead.
It is a reference to the skills of the ABD.
So part of what Bonnie is saying there is that when you work in the area of the ABD, you begin to see the world in that way. And it bypasses, Ivan, as you were saying, the whole concept of the linear brain and its occlusion. It's just a different thing. You see it in a different manner. It's an exciting way to live. Thank you for that, Bonnie. Harry, we're going to go ahead and take another week on this, but I'd like to remind you in the posting that you had on the wingsofchaos.com is you posted about something that your Austin group had posed, something you guys came up with in working on this chapter. Do you remember that, what that is, or would you like me to read that?
You mean the question that came up?
Yep.
Yeah, because we reached that point in the chapter.
Oh, I think I have it here. Yeah, let me see. Well, David, why don't you read it? I don't have it right in front of me.
So Harry and his group in Austin worked through Life in the Labyrinth vigorously some time ago. And here's one of the things that came up on this chapter. In our Austin group, the following question suggested itself when beginning this chapter. If you could see another person without all the occlusions and projections, what would you see? It turned out that this question was useful not only for the answers it prompted, which were a few, but for the new questions it generated, which were many. What would you see? If you could see another person without all the occlusions and projections, what would you see? I have an example.
Okay. An example. All
right. Many, many years ago, I was invited to go to the L.A. Convention Center. There was a trade show of craft. It was a craft trade show, and I was invited to go down there to participate with EJ. In the he had a jewelry booth. I really enjoyed selling the jewelry. It was really a lot of fun. And I didn't really know him very well. I hadn't really met him. I think I maybe had been to one convention by then. But I was just getting to know him as a person. So here I am in this huge if you've ever been to these conventions, so these huge shows with hundreds upon hundreds of booths and people teeming around. So we're working this booth, and there are all kinds of things happen. So at one point, he goes to take a break, and he's walking down the road or the aisle with two other individuals, who I remember exactly who it is, and he's walking down the road, and I was watching him, and I thought there was something so odd about it. And I watched him, and I thought how normal he looked. It's like he looked unusually normal. And I thought about that for a long time as I watched him walking away. It's like he was doing that.
Right.
Get it? Mm-hmm. He wasn't acting mechanically to be that way. he was being that way. And I'll never forget that, because I was seeing somebody at that moment who was not operating from occlusions.
Yeah, right. Okay.
So,
but I thought the question was, if you were not operating from occlusions.
No, no. Read the question. Oh, here, I'll read the question again.
Yeah.
It says, it's actually a very, very smart question.
Okay.
If you could see another person without all the occlusions and perceptions, what would you see? Now, it's
isn't
a double.
Without all my occlusions and perceptions?
Or.
Without their conclusions?
Do they have.
And projections, not.
And projections.
Yeah.
What would you see? In other words, I read this, Harry, and I don't know if you guys meant it this way. I took it in two ways. What would it look like if I saw somebody who was free of occlusions and projections?
Mm-hmm.
The other way was, what would I see if I were free of occlusions and projections when I saw
See, there goes them? Those multiplier effect on questions.
That's right. So both
those
of those
are good questions,
vibrant.
David.
Pardon?
Yeah, those are very good questions, David.
Yeah. And I think that we do see people from time to time who are not locked into occlusions and projections. In order for us to see those individuals, we have to not be in occlusions and projections. Sometimes we're surprised out of it. The other day at our local health food store here called Briar Patch, you know, there's a teeming of people all the time. I just happened to notice somebody. And that person was freer in a certain way. Like, why did my attention get drawn to that? Like, I was compelled to watch this person. Like, they were moving and acting in an unusual way. And my radar was up for that, and I saw it. We've all seen that. We've all had that. All I do is I'm just saying, I'm pointing out what many of us have experience as doing. I'm just saying that our job is to, let's note those and don't make them as just accidents of our life and livelihood as we go through here. But those are mark points on the team of the essential self. Okay? So let's vote for those guys sometimes. So that's it for tonight. And it's part
of. Thank you for a great class, Ivan, David.
Thank you for
supporting us, Harry. And with your background, it was very, very useful. And that's
very interesting. There are some very interesting comments on the log also.
Yeah, good. I'm going to read the log.
I'll have the log up in the next couple of days. And so this is the end of Part 1, Chapter 5, Life in the Labyrinth. We'll take it up again next week, Wednesday at 7 o'clock. Thanks for being there. Thank you, Ivan.
Thank you, everyone.
Good night.
Good night.